Dad claims, with some substance, that it was the only show ever to open on Broadway that closed at the end of the first act. I don't think it closed at the end of the first act, but according to Robert Benchley, who reviewed it, the only merit of the show was that the curtain went up. The claim was that there was no one left in the audience at the end of the first act.
But 3 years later, Todd scored a Broadway hit. The show was The Hot Mikado, starring the great Bill Bojangles Robinson.
My object all sublime, I shall achieve in time, to let the punishment fit the crime, the punishment fit the crime. And I'll make each prisoner pimp, unwillingly represent, a source of innocent merriment, of innocent merriment. And object all sublime, he will achieve in time, to let the punishment fit the crime, the punishment fit the crime. And make each prisoner pimp unwilling to represent, yeah, a source of innocent merriment, of innocent merriment.
After years in the shadow of Shirley Temple, Bill Robinson made an immense personal success as Mike Todd's Mikado. Only one thing troubled the great dancer, that Gilbert and Sullivan never came backstage to say hello. Todd, however, had much bigger troubles. His show was so expensive to run that it was losing money. He solved the problem by going to Grover Whalen, who was running the 1939 New York World's Fair, and as Mike Jr. tells it, Mike Sr. said,
"Look, you've got this cultural disaster on your hands, this hall of music. You're playing these concert attractions that are doing no business. If you give me $15,000-$20,000, I will do you the great favor of moving this hit show out to your disaster theater here," which, in fact, is what happened. And it was a tremendous success at the fair, grossed more than any legitimate theatrical attraction in the history of the American music theater had ever grossed, because he was doing 14 shows a week. The show was a gigantic success, doing $80,000-$90,000, which even today is a successful amount, but was a hit musical in New York those days that did $30,000 was a fantastic success.
Such a success that Todd followed it up the following year with another World's Fair winner. It was called The Streets of Paris, and it starred two very un-Parisian comedians.
Hey, Abbott, I just wrote a joke. I'll tell it, if I may.
Now, that's a silly thing to say. There's no new jokes today.
Whether jokes are old or new, just telling them is lots of fun. You dig up some old pun and say, have you heard this one?
Hey, Costello, no smoking.
Hey, Abbott, who's smoking?
You are.
What makes you think I'm smoking?
Hey, you've got a cigar in your mouth.
I got my shoes on, but I ain't walking.
Laugh, laugh, laugh. There's lots to be thankful for. Laugh, laugh, laugh. Things have been worse before. If you're double-crossed by the friends you pick, pushed around and above and beaten and kicked, they may have you down, but you'll never be licked if you laugh, laugh, laugh.
Hey, Abbott. How about those girls we had out last night?
Now, don't get personal, Costello.
You got no kick coming, Abbott. You had the best-looking one.
What do you mean?
Yours had teeth.
Well, yours had teeth, too.
I'll say she did. Mine had so much bridge work, every time I kissed her, I had to pay toll.
Laugh, laugh, laugh. There's lots to be thankful for. Laugh, laugh, laugh. Things have been worse before.
If your wife runs away with your pal, don't cry, or carry a torch and long to die.
You should feel sorry for the other girl.
If you laugh, laugh, laugh.
Abbott and Costello's co-star in The Streets of Paris was an elegant lady who was billed by Todd as the best undressed woman in America, Gypsy Rose Lee. The review opened at the World's Fair to excellent notices and brisk business. The critic Burns Mantle wrote of Gypsy's performance, "She is careful not to take off more than she has on." The Streets of Paris wasn't the only Todd production at the 1940 Fair. There was also Dancing Campus, which featured in constant rotation the top dance bands of the day. There was Harry James. There was Gene Krupa. There was Les Brown. Singing with Les Brown in Dancing Campus was the band's brand new vocalist, a 17-year-old ex-dancer named Doris Day.
Tain't me, baby, GM Blue. Tain't me that you sigh those tender sighs to. Tain't me, but I wish that it could be. Tain't me that you tell those sweetest lies to. Tain't me, baby, that's so plain to see. I remain just the same. Won't complain, kinda feel that I'm to blame. Tain't me that your hungry heart cries out to. Tain't me. Maybe someday could be me.
Also appearing in Dancing Campus was a young singer who a decade later played opposite Doris Day in a series of Warner Brothers musicals. His name was Gordon McRae. Even more successful than Dancing Campus was Todd's 10-acre amusement center, Gay New Orleans. He said at the time, "I'm just the guy for both places. I've never been to New Orleans and I've never been to college." After the World's Fair closed, Todd decided to do another Broadway show. This one was a burlesque show. Well, no, it wasn't. It was a revue. You see, burlesque was a forbidden word in 1942, ever since all the Minsky striptease theaters had been closed by illegal killjoy. Supreme Court Judge Aaron J. Levy had called burlesque inartistic filth and banned it, thereby creating just what a showman needs, a demand. Todd signed up the cream of the unemployed burlesque stars and put together what he called Star and Garter, a Review. Though the tired businessmen obviously wouldn't be going to a show like Star and Garter for the musical content, Todd included in the score a classic Johnny Mercer Harold Arlen song that he felt had been unfairly passed over by the Academy Award judges the year before.
My mama done told me when I was in pigtail. My mama done told me a man's gonna sweet talk and give you the glad eye. When that sweet talking's done, a man is a two-faced, a worrisome thing who'll leave you to sing the blues in the night. Now the rains have fallen here, the trains are calling, hoo-wee. My mama done told me here whistle blowing across the trestle. From Memphis to Mobile, from Memphis to St. Joe, wherever the four winds blow. I've been to some big towns, I've heard me some big talk, but there is one thing I know. A man is a two-faced, a worrisome thing who'll leave you to sing the blues in the night. La, la, la. My mama done told me the blues in the night.
Because Todd had sunk every penny he had into Star and Garter, he couldn't afford to take it on an out-of-town tryout tour. Instead, he gambled that all the show's problems could be sorted out after a single New York preview the night before the opening. Well, Mike lost the gamble, and the preview was a mess. The show looked so hopeless that the principal backer snatched back his money and headed for the hills. But the star of the show, Gypsy Rose Lee, was a gambler too. She dipped into her considerable savings and came up with enough money to get new acts, new costumes, new sets, and new material. Or at any rate, new old material. Todd put in some sketches that had penicillin on them. The song in the first act finale had been around quite a bit as well.
Oh, my search will never cease for the girl on the police gazette. For the pretty young brunette on the pink police gazette. And above my mantelpiece, there's a page of the Police Gazette with a pretty young brunette on the pink Police Gazette. I'd love to stop at my favorite barber shop just to take another look at the girl that I have. Yeah, and my longing will increase for the girl on the Police Gazette. For the pretty young brunette,
young brunette
on the pink Police Gazette.
A week after its disastrous preview, Star and Garter opened to shouts of joy from the critics. The tired businessman was even more enthusiastic and kept the Music Box Theatre full for over 600 performances. While Mike was enjoying the triumph of his show, three musical comedy experts were having trouble with theirs. Cole Porter and the prolific brother and sister team, Herbert and Dorothy Fields, had written an Ethel Merman vehicle which their producer, Vinton Friedley, found wanting. Feeling that Friedley was only demanding changes for change's sake, Porter and the Fieldses decided to take their brainchild to a less finicky producer. This was Porter's cue to suggest Todd, who intrigued the composer. Porter once said, "I like anyone who happens to be slightly crazy," and feeling that Todd more than filled the bill, Porter phoned him saying that he'd be happy to play and sing the songs for him. Todd dismissed the idea. He admired Porter and the Fieldses so much that he bought their show sight unseen and score unheard.
Never give up doing something for the boys. What if that sweater you started did turn out to be a muffler with short sleeves? What if that chocolate cake did turn out to be no good? There's something every man, woman, and child in this great land of ours can do, and that is to buy more war bonds than we're buying now. Get that new suit you were going to buy. You wouldn't look good in a repleat anyhow. Postpone that trip you were going to take till the war's over. And help get it over with buying war bonds with every dollar you can scrape together.
Ethel Merman with Something for the Boys. A truly escapist musical about a lady defense worker who, because of the carborundum in her fillings, received vital wartime radio messages through her teeth. This less than distinguished plot had one advantage. It allowed for a wide variety of Cole Porter songs. One of them had to do with the wartime dance band craze.
If a girl in any sector makes you feel like a puppy called Hector, and you're longing to subject her, to elect her your wife and protect her, if she's just as sweet as nectar, but of your job she's no respecter, become a top band director, and you never, never will miss.
In the gilded age of Wall Street, millionaire was the answer to a working maiden's prayer. But today she'd chuck that nearly 50 grand for the leader of a big time band. In the days when Casanova was the tops, all his rivals with the fins were famous flops. But today who's got that extra gonadic glass? Time band.
When Goodman Champ of Champs goes blowing blue, rum-ridden debutantes nearly come to.
Cause nothing when you're out like being bad. I'm a leader of a big time band.
Chaps who wore their shafts would wear them down.
But today the only rider they demand is the leader of a big time band.
When Stallone got John the Bean by the head, it appears he wasn't kosher in the bed.
But today who'd be the coy she'd like to land? The leader of a big time. Begins to tilt that horn about. Dear Mrs. Vanderbilt bumps herself out. So when you say you still can play a one night stand and a one and a two and a three, be the leader of a big time band.
Before we leave Something for the Boys, let me just add that its original title was Jenny Get Your Gun. 3 years later, the authors Dorothy and Herbert Fields rehashed their unused title for another Ethel Merman hit, but Annie Get Your Gun wasn't a Mike Todd show. His next was Mexican Hayride, again with a score by Cole Porter. Todd had the huge Winter Garden Theatre in mind for his show, but unfortunately a rival management already had a hit playing there. The star of that hit was comedian Milton Berle.
Well, it was the longest-running Ziegfeld Follies, 82 weeks. It opened at the Winter Garden, then we moved to the Imperial. I'll tell you how we moved to the Imperial. Michael Todd came up with a show called Mexican Hayride, which starred Bobby Clark, with a score by Cole Porter. He wanted the Winter Garden Theater, but the Follies was in there. Well, he romanced me so much that he gave me two vicuna coats. He gave my former wife, at that time Joyce Matthews, I think, a sable. I don't know where he got it. He must have got it from somebody. And we moved the show to the Imperial, which was a smaller cedar. But Michael Todd moved his Mexican hayride in there.
Girl, to the right of me. Girl, to the left of me. Girls in front of me. Girls behind. Girls all over. I don't mind. Oh, what a rogue am I. Oh, watching Vogue am I. Simply smothered in kisses and curls by the girls, 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 girls. What do I go mad for? What are bank accounts bad for? What was Adam Spank for? Wow, wow. What should heaven be thankful?
The best-known song in Mexican Hayride came about, according to Mike Todd Jr., like this.
Dad had had somewhat the misfortune never to really have any of his great evergreens in any of his shows. And during the rehearsal period of Mexican Hayride, Dad was sort of voicing a bit of a complaint that a lot of the music was too special and a little too tricky with the lyric ideas, and he had the temerity to suggest to Cole Porter that he write a song. Cole Porter said, "What kind of a song do you want?" Dad said, "Well, I'd like a song called I Love You," at which Cole Porter could barely conceal his mirth, saying, "Well, Mike, look," and tolerantly explaining to him, "there are already 17 I Love Yous." And Dad said, "Well, we'll call this one Cole Porter's I Love You." Now, Cole Porter was quite a bit on the limp-wristed side, and the director of the show was as well, a fellow by the name of Hazard Short. They both had in attendance nephews, in heavy quotation marks, that were through the rehearsal period with them. And the following morning, Porter sat down at the piano and started to play it. "I love you, hums the April breeze.
I love you, echo the hill. I love you, the golden dawn agrees, as once more she sees daffodils. It's spring again, and birds on the wing again start to sing again the old melody. I love you, that's the song of songs, and it all belongs to you and me, and it all belongs to you and me."
Mike's next production was a play about Catherine the Great, starring one of the theater's most distinguished dramatic actresses.
I believe that everyone in life should have a mission. Making people happy is the height of my ambition. And when I get them happy, well, they stay in that condition. I have a system all my own. I got a lot of what I got. And what I got's all mine. And I'll show you. I can show you if you're feeling blue. Come up and see me sometime. I got a flat where you can hang your hat. I got a brand new line. Maybe you would like me to explain it all to you. Come up and see me sometime. Come up tonight. I think the paper said the moon will be bright. They should have had it in the columns and all letters that fall that you'll be falling for me. 'Cause I'm free and you appeal to me. How could it be a if you don't get my number, well, my number's in the book. Come up and see me sometime.
Yes, in a new play, Catherine was great. And Mae West revealed for the first time that the Scarlet Empress had quite a way with a suggestive song. Other than that, though, the play had no surprises whatever. Todd tried to get Miss West to rewrite it, but she liked it the way it was, and if he happened to be smoking one of his big cigars, she wouldn't even let him near her. It was a very expensive production. Todd had to hire 29 stagehands to change the scenes, and it lost a lot of money. Mike's next production, though, was a hit. A Sigmund Romberg musical called Up in Central Park.
The stately old trees were surrounding the breeze in the small carousel in the park. The children and nurses quite empty their purses to ride to the music and shout all the verses. It's simply enchanting to see Grandma panting sedately atop a white horse. For children and grandma go home when it's dark, and then every lover is free to discover the small carousel in the park.
One of the songs from a show which, as Mike Todd Jr. explains,
was a partial triumph of the material and a partial triumph of his entrepreneurial know-how, because he opened the show on a Saturday night, which was unheard of. The idea was that the reviews get written that night and appear in the following day's papers. Saturday night, the Sunday paper has already gone to bed, most sections of it except for the hard national and international news. It's gone to bed like Thursday or Friday, certainly the theatrical section. And he threw in Central Park, at a casino in Central Park, the most spectacular kind of period party at which everybody had a fantastic time. There was a real smudging or confusion as to how successful the show was and how successful the party. Well, the show was a good show, and actually, because it was mostly curtains without hard scenery and no big-name actors, had the lowest budget of any musical around in those days, and the lowest production cost. And he bought a theater at the same time from the Schuberts, a theater that was way out of the Broadway theater district, immediately adjoining Central Park, wound up owning the theater and making a gigantic fortune, but some of it was due to the party, I believe.
Up in Central Park was the result of Todd's reading a book about Boss Tweed, a corrupt New York politician whose dubious activities touched off a sort of 19th century Watergate scandal. It was Romberg's first hit show for 15 years, and the music showed him to be as melodic as ever.
We'll be close as pages in a book, my love and I. So close we can share a single look, share every sigh. So close that before I hear your laugh, my laugh breaks through. And when a tear starts to appear, my eyes grow misty too. Our dreams won't come tumbling to the ground. We'll hold them fast, darling. As the strongest book is bound, we're bound to last. Your life is my life, and while life beats away in my heart, we'll be close as pages in a book, never to part.
Mike Todd did make a number of mistakes during his colorful career. In the late 1930s, he turned down a young comedienne called Betty Hutton because he didn't think she was worth $100 a week. In 1943, after the out-of-town tryout of a new musical called Away We Go, his verdict was, no gags, no gals, no chance. The show's title was changed to
Oklahoma!
But suddenly, all of Todd's decisions seemed to be wrong ones. He presented two unsuccessful plays in a row. He married Joan Blondell and divorced her. He was given his own production unit at Hollywood, but never made a film. There were whispers that he was flat broke. Suddenly, Mike surprised the whisperers by presenting a new musical. It was about America's first woman president and was called As the Girls Go. The music for the new show was by the late Jimmy McHugh. The lyrics by Harold Adamson.
In early 1948, Jimmy McHugh and myself wrote a song called It's a Most Unusual Day for a picture called A Date with Judy, which prophetically starred Elizabeth Taylor. In June of that year, Mike came out to the coast, and he called Jimmy and myself to meet him at his suite in the Wilshire Hotel. And he came right to the point, and he said, I'm going to do a show, and I want you guys to do it. I'm going to tell you an idea I got, and if you don't like it, I'm going to throw you out the window. That's the way he talked. Well, Mike told Jimmy and me that we could write the bulk of the score on the West Coast, and we wouldn't be needed in New York until August 1st. He said we could keep in touch by telephone, but I'll tell you that telephone was only one arm of the Todd operation. Between June and August, Mike would fly out two or three times a month to see how we were coming along. Well, where do you think we stayed in New York? At a hotel? That was not in the Todd tradition. We were all to be Mike's house guests for 5 weeks at his home in Irvington on the Hudson. Now, the Irvington place was an estate of 27 acres, adjoining the estate of the Duchess of Talleyrand, overlooking the Hudson River. One thing we quickly learned was that no one ever picks up a check with Mike Todd. Jimmy and I made the move a few times, but Mike would explode with one of his Toddisms. Waiter, these men have been drinking. If you take their money, they'll come back tomorrow and say they were robbed.
It's more fun than a picnic, just being in love. You feel like the queen of the Mardi Gras when you are in love. It's more fun than a circus, you're playing the clown and shouting it out from the chimney tops all over the town. It's more fun than running for president or making who's who.
Who cares?
It's more fun than a barrel of monkeys when love makes a monkey of you.
And it do.
It's all peaches and rainbows, blue heavens above. It's more fun than a picnic, just being in love.
Come on over here, children. What you got to say about love? What's the latest caper in that department, hmm?
It's more fun than reading the comics
and having a Coke in between,
or spending a nickel to buy a popsicle,
or tilting a pinball machine.
I call the cops.
It's more fun than blue jeans or yo-yo.
Oh, you know that's living.
And strawberry sodas and such.
And toasting marshmallows is more fun with fellows.
Yes, even when treating is Dutch. It's more fun than being a movie star and having your face on the screen, or sinking the putt when you're under par, or tilting the pinball machine.
As grown-ups would say, it's colossal.
It's great.
And no one can tell us it's dumb.
Quiet, Bills.
Roy Rogers and Trigger,
they don't even figure
it's bigger than bubblegum.
And that's bigger than Los Angeles and the extended area. Why, it's all peaches and rainbows, blue heavens above.
It's more fun than a picnic,
just being in love.
So in love, just being in love.
We used to work late in his office in the Playhouse Theater in New York, sometimes till 1, 2, 3 in the morning. One story that amused me was he had a secretary called Belle Postal. One night we were working, it was about midnight, and Belle opened the door and peeked in and said, Mr. Todd, it's 12 o'clock, do you think you're going to need me anymore? And Mike says, oh, no, take the rest of the afternoon off.
And while everyone worked to prepare as the girls go, Mike was up to his ears in problems. He went bankrupt.
Yes, he did. When he went bankrupt, he didn't change his style of living at all because he still had a penthouse and four telephones and so forth. And when people criticized him, he said, "What do you expect me to do, cut down on my cigars?"
Thanks to money borrowed from God knows where, As the Girls Go finally opened in Boston for its out-of-town tryout. Mike Todd, Jr.
In Boston, everything went wrong. It was just a total shambles. And in 10 days or a week, he pulled it together, and it was a gigantic success. And a press agent that used to work for Dad claimed he deliberately manufactured confusion and chaos so that everybody would be totally paralyzed with fear and he would have the complete autonomy that only fear can inculcate in the others so that he could take complete control of a project.
However he achieved it, As the Girls Go was a hit, filling the huge Winter Garden Theater for a healthy 420 performances. But his next production, Michael Todd's Peep Show, that was something else again.
Peep Show was the nearest thing he ever had to a musical failure. It did wind up making money. The show had been a fantastic success. It was another high-class burlesque show. In Philadelphia, it had been a raving success. The thing was all shaped up, ready to open in New York, opening night. Dad had a tendency to be late for any event, including his own openings. But they had gone through a last afternoon dress rehearsal. It had gone marvelously. Dad was back at his apartment putting on his tux. It was a little late. He didn't have to be there. The show would go on anyways without him. But he suddenly, in a taxi on the way to the theater, had the premonition that he was in terrible trouble based on the following. The Korean War had just started about 5 days prior. Dad, without being a super patriot, but nevertheless feeling patriotic about America and the kind of opportunity it represented for the son of an immigrant and that kind of business, always played, just on the opening night, the Star Spangled Banner before the show's overture. And as was his custom, his musical conductor would assume that Todd wanted to play the Star Spangled Banner that evening. And Dad hopped out of the taxi, phoned the general manager at the theater to see whether the show had started, and it had, and they had played the Star Spangled Banner. And for a real lightweight kind of burlesque show, the idea of playing the Star Spangled Banner 5 days after commencement of the war was something that put everybody in a somber frame of mind and took a bit of the edge off the show. His timing was about 15 minutes off in that instance. Did make a difference.
Earlier, when he was assembling the score for Peep Show, Todd went to an old friend from his early days in Chicago, the composer Julie Stein.
I grew up with Mike in Chicago. Mike was one of the greatest promoters, one of the greatest salesmen, one of the greatest hustlers I ever met in my life. I remember he came from Waukegan, I think it was. He settled down in Chicago. And I used to pal around with Mike. I wasn't a songwriter then. I was just a piano player around Chicago, and he liked me. He says, you ain't going to be this. You know, you're going to be better. And Mike opened an office. Now, I was his partner. Our office was on the 18th floor of the Masonic Temple in Chicago, the Oriental Theater building in Chicago. But the 18th floor was the Masonic Hall, where the Masons met once a week. So we used to take the minister's pulpit into the office, and his desk was a pulpit, two pulpits put together, his desk, and he did all his looking standing up. We put a long cord onto a telephone, which was there for the Masons in an anteroom. We pulled it in to our office, and then we'd get these high Masonic chairs, well, the officiates of the Masonic order sit. And Mike sat in one of those, and we had our own little signs, and Mike Todd Productions. Every night we'd take little wooden sign off, hide it, put all the pulpit chairs back in the Masonic Hall, and when we left, it was an empty office. Anyhow, one day Mike came to me and said, "I've got an idea for a show for the Chicago Theater. There's a girl by the name of Faith Bacon, and she does a fan dance. But I'm going to do a number with her, a production in Chicago Theater called The Moth and the Flame." I said, "The Moth and the Flame? You are out of your mind, Mike." "No," he said, "I found a fellow who's got a thing that you can wrap around a person and only burns on the outside. It never touches you. You can be burning, but you never get burned." I said, "How are you going to get this girl to get inside? You set fire to her. What if the thing doesn't work?" He says, it's been tested. I want you to write a song called A Tune, The Moth and the Flame. I said, well, who's going to write the lyrics? He said, what do you mean, who's going to write the lyrics? I am. I said, well, what are the lyrics about, Mike? He says, you know, the moth and the flame, and you are to blame. I said, oh, no. He says, write it. Just write the tune. I'll have the words. I'm going over to Sully. He came back in about an hour. He says, well, I sold the whole production and the song, and he gave me $200. I says, is that what you got? And Mike said, no, I took $300. I think I'm entitled $100 for selling it.
But to return to Peep Show, this is one of the songs Stein wrote for it.
We've got to stay with the happy people. Have your fun, live in the land of joy. Stay with the happy people. Face the sun, life is a Christmas joy. Down through the endless ages, tears have been contagious. And take it from me, that misery is looking around for company. So stay, stay, stay with the happy people. Don't wrinkle your brow, it's strictly out of style. Just stay, stay, stay with the people who live, 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 and the people who love, love, love to wear a smile.
Julie Stein clearly remembers the day that Todd got in touch with him again.
He came to me many years later. Remember, many years later when he came to me, he says, Julie, I need three songs in Peep Show. The show opened in Philadelphia, and it's terrible. Will you write me three songs? I got Bob Hilly. We wrote three songs. I said, Mike, I don't want you to give me any money for this, but I want you to give 1% of the gross to my sons. He never paid it. Never. He meant to, but he never did. I never sued him or anything like that because I knew him too well. I knew that if he had it, he'd have given it to me, but he didn't. He probably was in hock for that show, and he was always in hock. More shows of his were in hock to people just for... He was that kind of a guy. He went overboard on everything, you know. When he believed in something, that's when he got in trouble.
Francie, don't be highfalutin' me, Francie. If it ever suited your fancy, you'd ask for stars in the sky. I wonder why you aim so high. That part of your personality loses reality. All I've got is Francie. Haven't any treasures but Francie. Life has many pleasures you can't see till you're in love. You'll never know what a kiss is worth till you come down to earth right where an angel should be. If you want my love, Francie, don't get fancy with me.
After Peep Show, Todd presented two ill-fated straight plays. The critics' reaction to one of them achieved something his son Mike Jr. didn't think possible.
I only saw him depressed once in my life. While he had never produced a stage musical that was a failure, he virtually never produced a straight play without music that was a success. He was, strangely, until he married Joan Blondell, quite puritanical about drink. He did road shows during the 30s, vaudeville shows that ran with motion pictures. And he was always distrustful, usually of the comedian who drank excessively and caused him endless troubles. A half a drink was his capacity. I don't recall which show it was, but I remember waking up one morning at about 4 with a great deal of noise in the apartment, and there was Dad sitting in a bathtub saying, don't let Michael see me. And he had had 4 drinks that night because the reviews had come in bad and the show was a failure.
But the ever-resilient Mike was soon back presenting the kind of show he understood.
No love can ever be the one and only. One and only is only make-believe because you're bound to kiss on the seashore. Many beaches, are there to kiss?
Let us kiss.
Are there to love?
Let us love.
So many opportunities. Are there to kiss?
Let us kiss.
Are there to love?
Let us love.
So many are there chances.
Here together just for tonight. Here together just for delight. Why waste time in talking of love? Let us kiss just tonight. Here in the dark, love is the lark. Unmysterious, hardly serious. Knowing when, love is the end. We will love, finding love, once again.
That music was sung in a real lagoon in Jones Beach, California, with the night sky for a backdrop. The spellbound spectators saw an operetta that featured gondolas, ships, and during the fireworks polka, a real fireworks display. The same show business flair was evident when Mike and Elizabeth Taylor decided to get married.
His marriage to Elizabeth took place just south of Acapulco in Mexico. There were about 30 people invited guests. Well, instead of being one of the participants, he made an exciting evening out of it. He hired a troupe of Cuban dancers. The ceremony took place at sunset, and in back of the house on the bay, there were some hills, and as the sun went down, out of the hills came these torch lights from nowhere. He had constructed a small grandstand for the 30 members of the wedding to sit in, and these torches came out of the hill, and I guess you could call it sort of a native fertility dance was done, and then a gigantic fireworks display. His own wedding was a production, and something that he took a great deal of pleasure in doing.
He also had a wonderful time producing his long-awaited first film. Around the World in 80 Days was filmed in 13 different countries, and sometimes weeks passed before the actors were paid. At one time, the sheriff of Los Angeles locked up all the film Todd had shot until he paid a lot of outstanding bills. Yet, the work went on as Harold Adamson well knows.
The music was written by Victor Young, and it was the main musical theme of the whole picture. Mike said to me, well, I know you can't write a song called Around the World in 80 Days. He says, but maybe you can just take part and say Around the World something else, you know, and maybe you could write me a hit song out of it. So I said, well, I'll give it a go. Well, the picture made such a great, great, great impact, and the theme made such an impact, and everybody started recording it. Gosh, it was all over the place, you know, and Mike said to me, why are they playing it so much? It's vulgar, he said.
Around the world, I've searched for you. I travel on when hope was gone to keep a rendezvous. I knew somewhere, sometime, somehow, you'd look at me and I would see the smile you're smiling now. It might have been in County Down or in New York, in Cape Harry or even London Town. No more will I go all around the world, for I have found my world.
The massive success of Around the World in 80 Days enabled Todd to put a few things straight, says composer Johnny Green.
Must be said about Mike that when he finally hit it so big with Around the World, and that was big by anybody's standards, I mean that was tens of millions of dollars, he paid every debt that he ever had, and he had debts all over the place. I mean, from his dentist to the 21 Club in New York, you name it. He owed tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars. He paid back every cent he owed to anybody.
Todd's first film, which won five Oscars, including the Best Film Award, was also his last. He had plans for a dozen follow-up projects when a plane taking him to New York crashed on a mountain early one morning in March 1958, and he was killed. He'd been chosen Showman of the Year and was to have been guest of honor at a dinner in Manhattan. And so ended the incredible career of the flamboyant Mike Todd. Let his son have the final word.
He was a man who never looked back. He would profit by his experience and use the knowledge, but never worried about yesterday's defeat. He was always thinking about tomorrow's victory. And the title I had used for a book I tried to write a few years ago was You Can't Spend Your Life on the Roller Coaster, which was a term he used about Cinerama. But the fact is, he did spend his life on a roller coaster. And it was a never-ending successions of ups and downs, starting when he was 17. He made a fortune in the construction business when he was 17, 18, and the bonding house that was in back of him failed, and he lost $1 million before he was 19. Most people never make the first million, and if they do, they're commiserating about it the rest of their lives. Dad spent his life on the roller coaster, one up, one down, but never felt badly about the one that went down, just went on to the one up that was coming.
Mike Todd's story in the American Showman series was presented by Michael Craig, researched by Bill Sullivan, written by Dick Vosborough, and the producer was David Raven Allen. Now, Benny Green has a few words to say by way of postscript and preview.
Had Mike Todd not been killed prematurely, there's no telling what he might not have achieved in the way of show business showmanship. Perhaps more than any of the other latter-day producers, with the possible exception of Billy Rose, Todd harked back to the days of the old-time showmen, the 19th-century impresarios who were a cross between robber barons, accountants, and members of the average audience with the conscience extracted. Next week, we'll take a look at this prehistoric world before the antitrust laws forced people to trust each other, before the performers had any union to join apart from matrimony. In other words, the days when the musical theatre was wide open for any ruthless, competent businessman who had faith in his own ability to tell the difference between a winner and a loser. It's hard to define exactly the moment when ancient history becomes modern folklore, but it's probably at some time around the premature death of the great balladeer Stephen Foster, and the success of a much less sophisticated artist who gave his name to a form of entertainment still remembered. Foster died penniless, but Edwin Christie went on from strength to strength, blacking up in every town in America, singing naive melodies with naive lyrics which appealed to the naive audiences of those times.
Can't the ladies sing this song? Do da, do da. Can't the respect my mother? Oh, do da, day.
I try I'm done, done with my hat caved in.
Doo-da, doo-da,
I go back home with a pocket full of tin.
Oh, doo-da, hey.
Why is the land all night? Why is the land all day? I set my money on a ball cat night. I'm playing as I'm a man. Why is the land all night? Why is the land all day? I set my money on a ball cat night. I'm playing as I'm a man.
The moment when naivety merges into capitalism comes with the emergence of a monopoly called the Syndicate, which concealed the personalities of Abraham Lincoln Erlinger and Mark Claw, who was such a pleasant fellow that the wag said that Mark Claw left a claw mark. The Syndicate had this system whereby any money which came onto Broadway was regarded as theirs by right, and they never were outwitted until the eventual arrival of a new syndicate, even more conscienceless than they were, the Schubert Brothers. This was, of course, the era of lush Ruritanian melody, written by European masters and their American imitators. Nobody cared much about the plot. Melody was everything. It was Franz Lehár's Merry Widow that put the cap on the whole era, and a pretty feathered cap it was, too. It took years for the American homegrown school of writers to overcome the goulash prejudices caused by the success of the Merry Widow school. But slowly, as Claw and Erlinger faded out, so did the European dominance, and writers like Jerome Kern and George Gershwin began to be heard in the productions of men like Charlie Dillingham. Now, Dillingham was a real card, a big spender who had two homes, one to live in, the other one was a gymnasium, in which he jumped to various conclusions daily and planned a lot of successful shows and a few not-so-successful ones. The trouble was that it was all so chaotic that it was hard to tell the successes from the flops, as Robert Russell Bennett demonstrates when he talks about one of Dillingham's biggest hits.
Charles B. Dillingham was, to me, I think, the most attractive man I ever met as a producer. He was a marvelous gambler, and he did quite a number of successful shows, and one that we did had Marilyn Miller and Jack Donahue and Clifton Webb and Mary Hay, and it was called Sonny. Well, we had a wonderful cast, and we opened in Philadelphia, and it was a shambles. There's never been anything such a horror in the opening history that I ever saw or heard. And I was standing in the back, and after the first act of the first performance in Philadelphia at the tryout, here comes Charlie B. Dillingham, all happy and smiling, and I looked at him. He said, well, it's better than it was last night, isn't it?
That remark of Charlie Dillingham's epitomises the attitude of the old hit-or-miss impresarios, all now vanished from the scene as utterly as the dinosaur the dodo. They were a breed of men who backed their fancy, and if it didn't come off, they shrugged their shoulders, whistled a new tune, and went off in search of another libretto, another score, and a fresh list of backers. The whole breed is accidentally summed up by a song that was written for one of those casual, light-as-thistle-down shows. It was written by Jerome Kern, the first young American composer to establish a homegrown school, and part written also by an English ex-public schoolboy who loved the theatre because he found so much daft, raw material for his comic novels. He was P.G. Woodhouse, and this song expresses his philosophy, and even more so, that of the impresarios who employed him for so long, and even paid him, too, from time to time.
Look for the silver lining whene'er a cloud appears in the blue. Remember somewhere the sun is shining, and so
Benny Green was talking about the American Showman, and Michael Craig continues the story next week, next Tuesday at 7:30, tracing the story of the emergent days of the modern American musical theatre, 7:30 to 8:30 next Tuesday.